In this final month leading up to the November election, candidates around the country are talking a lot about helping the middle class. They want middle class tax breaks and middle class jobs. But who exactly are they talking about? Here to tell us about the latest data defining the much discussed middle class is NBR senior business editor Marilyn Geewax. Welcome.
Hi.
So how do we define middle class?
In this country, most people really do view themselves as being neither rich nor truly poor. They see themselves as being somewhere in the middle, and technically that's probably right. 4 out of 5 people are either above that federal poverty line or below the much-debated top level for taxable income. This year, the federal poverty line is set at about $11,000 annual income for one person, or $22,000 for a family of four. Now, how many people fit that? Well, about 14% of the U.S. population would be considered poverty-stricken by that standard. And about 2 or 3% of people are considered really well off. Those are those households that make $250,000 a year. Those people would see higher taxes if President Obama were to win this debate on fiscal policy. So everybody that's between those two extremes of rich and poor, they could make a claim to be in the middle class.
So if we're talking about 14% considered poor, 2 or 3 considered rich, that still leaves over 80% of the country. I mean, do economists have a narrower definition?
Well, to make it a more useful definition of what's middle class, you could whittle it down. The Census Bureau says that the median household income is just about exactly $50,000 a year. And median means that we've got a total of 117 million households. About half of them make more than $50,000 and half make less. But of all those households, you know, about 1/4 of them have just a single person working in the house.
So what's the median if 2 people are working?
Well, let's say you had a husband and a wife, and each one is working full time, and they're earning the median income for their respective gender. That household would make about $82,000 a year. So when we take into account everybody, the single people, the married couples, and you line up all the incomes, about half of all the people in this country would fit between 2 brackets, about $25,000 and $80,000 a year.
So this is a lot of numbers. What do the statistics actually tell us about people? How are they doing?
Well, the thing that's really become clear from all the data is that this recession has really bullied people in the middle class. They've seen their pay cut, home values have been cut, they've had reduced retirement earnings. In a lot of cases, people have permanently lost their jobs. The latest census data shows that about between 2008 and 2009, 4 million people fell out of the middle class altogether, and now they're living below that poverty line. In just the past year, the number of households collecting food stamps has jumped about 18%. So that means millions of people who used to be self-reliant are now being depending on the government to get their food on the table.
So is there anywhere in the country where the middle class is holding up well?
No. The new census data shows that no matter where you live, you probably felt squeezed. Because of layoffs and reduced work hours, income fell in 34 out of 50 states. North Dakota was really the only state where people saw any uptick in their earnings.
So what are people doing? How's the middle class coping?
NPR is going to take a look at that question later this week. Starting Wednesday, we're going to have a series of reports from all over the country about how middle-class people are dealing with all these financial strains. The series is called Living in the Middle, and we're going to have a lot of interesting information at NPR.org, too.
NPR senior business editor Marilyn Geewax. Thanks, Marilyn.
You're welcome.
Fall officially began nearly 2 weeks ago. But down in Florida, where essayist Diane Roberts lives, summer is in no hurry to pack up and leave.
Far more than spring, autumn brings a sense of rejuvenation, of endless possibility, of pumpkins and Christmas right around the corner. Corduroy and cashmere beckon seductively from the covers of fashion magazines, and the department stores want to sell you boots and sweaters. The sun has crossed the celestial equinox, so a new phase of the year has officially begun. But the problem is that the temperature here in the lower south missed the change of seasons memo. It's still hotter than possums fighting in a wool sack. The boys at Florida State and Georgia, LSU and Alabama are playing football, though there's no football weather in sight. If you want crisp, eat an icebox pickle. You still need the air conditioner. You're still wearing the summer cottons, and the leaves on the sweet gum trees are still resolutely green. The only place you'll see deep red and gold leaves is in a shop window. they're made of paper. And the only place it feels remotely autumnal is in the mall. The air is a fine 60-something degrees in there, brisk as a New England morning. In the mall, you can pretend that the first frost is just days away. You can contemplate wearing sleeves. You haven't done that since April. You try on that hunter green dress, that camel coat, that Glen plaid skirt. Not that you can wear any of those clothes anytime soon. Late October, maybe. Inside the mall, you'd think it was practically Thanksgiving, or at least Halloween. Not that the pumpkins have gotten ripe yet. Outside, the summer flowers, impatiens, zinnias, ginger lilies, are still blooming. But when the frost finally comes, the heater kicks on and the nights become sharp and starry. You'll button up that sweater and feel that finally you've caught up with the calendar.
Diane Roberts is a professor of creative writing at Florida State University in Tallahassee. She's eagerly awaiting a good freeze.
The falling leaves drift by the window. The autumn leaves of red and gold. I see your lips, the summer kisses, the sunburned hands I used to hold.
This is NPR News. In some parts of the world, a single computer, even one that we might think of as out of date, slow, or even worthless, can change many lives. In northern Fiji, reporter Louise Rafkin discovered what happens when the power of a rebuilt PC is combined with a lot of determination.
Nima Iwanga is 40 years old and a rarity in her seaside town of Savosavo. She's a businesswoman. She owns an instant photo shop.
Right now we are inside a shop, a small shop which we do instant photos.
Before, she and her husband fished for their livelihood and to feed their 9 kids. Now the Photoshop earns in a day what most in this town earn an entire week.
Everybody around Savosavo, they really get shocked when they come here and they see me with a computer in front of me. Because all the time they see me in the sea. And they said, "Oh, Nemai, how come you know this? Where do you learn computer?" And I just joked to them and said, "On top of the reef."
There's hardly room to turn around in the tiny shop. The single computer was built for her by John and Barbara Noel, American expats who run a computer store across the road. John Noel says it's all worth about $1,200 US.
She's earned many, many, many times as much money as we ever gave her to begin with.
It's a ready market. Fijians need personal photos when they fill out applications for school, for driving, for a telephone. Before Wanga started this business, you could get Polaroids in town, but they were expensive. Wanga was raised in a farming village, and she wants me to see just how far she's come, but she also has to work. So her son takes me on a bus and then by foot through the jungle to a cluster of thatched roof shacks. About 50 people live here. Days are spent working in the fields, growing food, and nights are spent singing under the stars. In miles, it's not that far from the Wanga's shop, but in some ways, it's really far. One of Wanga's children may eventually take on her business, but what she's already given her kids is an example how to think bigger. One by one, they tell me what they want to be when they grow up, a doctor, a veterinarian, a pilot. In a place where few finish elementary school, let alone go to college, they have high aspirations. But John, who's just 5 years old and named after Wanga's American benefactor, wants what many young Fijian boys want, to be a rugby star. For NPR News, this is Louise Rafkin. This is NPR News.
Before World War I, 90% of all African Americans lived below the Mason-Dixon line. But in the middle of the last century, the biggest internal migration in U.S. history took place. It was leaderless, and many people didn't even know they were a part of it. Reporter Isabel Wilkerson spent almost two decades tracing the lives of people who lived America's Great Migration, a period of 50 years where nearly 6 million African Americans left the South for northern cities. Her new book follows three families through the migration. It's called The Warmth of Other Suns.
There were three great waves of this migration, three great streams, and one of them went straight up the East Coast from Georgia, the Carolinas, to Washington, Philadelphia, New York, and Boston. That was the stream that my family personally was a part of. And then there was also the middle stream from Mississippi and Alabama to Chicago, Detroit, Cleveland, the Midwest. And then the third stream, which is from Louisiana and Texas to California.
One of the families you write about is the Gladney family. You interviewed Ida Mae Brandon Gladney, who died a few years ago. She left Mississippi for Chicago in 1937. And first of all, why did the family leave?
Well, it's interesting that she was not happy as a sharecropper's wife. She was a sharecropper's wife in Chickasaw County, Mississippi, not good at picking cotton. In fact, she was quite terrible at picking cotton. Mm-hmm. But the reason that they left was because a cousin of theirs was beaten nearly to death over a theft that he had not committed. Her husband, after seeing what had happened to his cousin, went home to her and said, "This is the last crop we're making." And they left for the North, first Milwaukee and then Chicago.
You also tell the story of George Swanson Starling. He's this brilliant student who couldn't afford an education, so he ended up working on an orchard in Florida. And then he made his way up to New York in 1945. Why did he go?
He left because he had clearly the education to be able to understand the mathematics of the work that they were doing. In other words, they were only being paid 10 or 12 cents a box.
These are obviously
citrus.
African-American.
Absolutely African-American citrus pickers at that time, which is the work he was doing after he had to leave school because the money had run out and there was no place he could go. And so he began to realize that what they were picking actually was going for so much more on the open markets. And he began to organize the pickers and say, "We should ask for 5 cents more per box. We are endangering our lives. We're having to climb up into these 30 and 40 foot trees. Sometimes people would fall out of the tree, break a limb, and it did not pay well." And so he began agitating for higher wages and fairer conditions, and the grove owners became angry, and he had to leave Florida basically for his life, and he went to New York.
And what happened to him in New York?
When he got to New York, he was able to find work, oddly enough, in a job that would take him right back south. He ended up working as a railroad porter, in which he began to be able to see the great migration unfold before him.
You write about the tension between African Americans who were already living in the North before the Great Migration began and then the new arrivals coming from the South. What was that tension like?
That tension to me is a very human reaction that also reminds me of how similar this was to an immigrant experience. It's often said that immigrants, once they arrive, are the first ones to want to close the door on any new arrivals. And that was the same thing here, partly because the people who were already there, the small group of people who had eked out a position as a tiny minority in these big cities, they really resented the arrival of these new people who they thought might pose a threat to the position and the status that they already had.
You describe how many African Americans from the South couldn't understand the northern accents of the rail conductors on the trains on which they were traveling, which may explain how the city of Newark, New Jersey, came to have a significant African American community.
It's quite interesting that there are two Pennsylvania stations, one right before the other, and after riding for 23 hours from the deepest part of the South, they were quite anxious to get to their destination, which for many of them clearly was New York. And so when Penn Station was announced and Newark sounded so close to New York, they got off the train prematurely.
And stayed. What are some of the changes that happened in the North as a result of the Great Migration?
The greatest legacy is probably the children of the Great Migration, meaning the reason why many of these people left. There's so many people who had opportunities to get education and to pursue careers that they might not otherwise have been able to do. Much of the literature of the 20th century grew out of the Great Migration. Toni Morrison, for example, August Wilson, Lorraine Hansberry, Ralph Ellison, Richard Wright, of course, who was practically the bard, the poet of the Great Migration. All of them, their work was informed by, infused by the Great Migration, which was in many ways their own stories. In sports, there are many aspects of sports we couldn't even imagine. People like Jesse Owens, Jackie Robinson, Arthur Ashe, many of even current people, Kobe Bryant and others, all have migration as part of their family history. And then probably the aspect that we probably take for granted more than anything is music. Mm. Music, as we know it in America, might not be what it is had it not been for the Great Migration. Motown, for example, simply would not have existed. Diana Ross, whose mother had come from Alabama, the Jackson family, their mother had come from Alabama, the Supremes, Florence Ballard and Mary Wilson, they were also from the South. John Coltrane migrated from North Carolina to Philadelphia at the age of 17, where he got his first alto sax. It's hard to fathom what jazz would be had he not gotten a hold of that first alto sax.
This story has been called, and you've called it in the book, one of the most underreported of the 20th century. I mean, we know about the Dust Bowl migration, the gold rush. The Great Migration has been written about, but not the entire sort of sweeping 55-year history of it, really until now. Why do you think that is?
I think because it went on for so long that it was hard to capture in one particular moment. It actually spanned three generations of reporters, you might say, who would not have been able to cover the whole thing and really grasp it as it was occurring. It's much easier now to look back on it and say, why wasn't it done?
In the book, you mention how so many of the older folks you interviewed, obviously most of them are older folks, they still have this kind of visceral and complicated relationship to the South. I guess the easiest way to describe it would be a kind of a love-hate relationship. Do you think that the South is still or will still be a fundamentally important part of the identity of African Americans in the future?
I absolutely do, because the vast majority of African Americans in the North, Midwest, and West are descended from people who were part of the Great Migration. Whenever anyone needs to go or wants to do genealogy or understand where their family came from, they must go back to the South. There is not really much of an option. But for me, I would hope that it would encourage people of all ethnicities to go to the oldest people in their families to better understand where they came from, because really we all have so much more in common than we've been led to believe. And I see such a connection between the immigrant heart of the people who were part of this Great Migration and that of so many other Americans that populated this country, where people left the only place they'd ever known for a place that they had never seen in hopes that life would be better. These people were no different.
That's author Isabel Wilkerson. Her new book is called The Warmth of Other Suns, The Epic Story of America's Great Migration. Isabel Wilkerson, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
If the phone book's on the way out, can phone book humor be far behind? The book's an eternal punchline, like in Steve Martin's classic moment in the movie The Jerk.
The new phone book's here! The new phone book's here!
Well, I wish I could get that excited about luck.
Nothing! Are you kidding? Page 73, Johnson, Maven, R. I'm somebody now! Millions of people look at this book every day! This is the kind of spontaneous publicity, your name in print, that makes people...
Of course, his character goes on to be shot at because his name is in the phone book. You may have heard the expression, his voice is so great I could listen to him read the phone book. Country singer Ken Mellons tests that theory in song.
Atkins, Adwell, Alexander, and Allen, Anderson, Apple, Armstrong, and Arnold, Babcock, Buck, Bacon and Bagwell, Bailey, Baker, Bandy and Banker, Barber, Barker, and Bobwell.
And then there's the meta moment of Robin Williams pretending to be acting legend John Houseman reading the phone book, as only a great comedian playing a great actor could do.
Anderson, Arthur, 95 Redpath, 555-1212. Teenager's phone, 555-8212. Nico Papadopoulopoulos, Nick.
What's to become of our comedy if we don't have the phone book to kick around anymore? YellowPages.com just doesn't have the same ring. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Rebecca Roberts.
This week, a freshman at Rutgers University committed suicide after his roommate and another student secretly put his sexual encounter online. Those students have been charged with invasion of privacy. The case raises questions about the prevalence and the power of public humiliation in our popular culture. NPR's Elizabeth Blair has a story.
Public humiliation has been around for a very long time.
All you have to do is think about, you know, burning someone at the stake or putting someone in the stocks, right, as a form of public punishment.
CJ Pasco teaches sociology at Colorado College.
New media simply changes the audience for this. Instead of having to actually be present for this type of public humiliation, we can spread it to larger and larger audiences.
And the audiences for public humiliation are huge. It's in large part why shows like Survivor, American Idol, and Kitchen Nightmares are so popular. It's entertaining to watch someone else get taken down.
Why did you decide to go into business if you haven't got a clue how to run a business?
What the hell was that?
Her mental state is not good, and in Survivor, you don't want to come across as mentally unstable.
Primetime TV is vulture culture, says longtime broadcast journalist Linda Ellerby.
Who's going to be voted off the island? Who is our weakest link? Which of you can we be nastiest to in order to win? And that is public humiliation for sport, and a lot of us love watching it.
Tomorrow night on Nickelodeon, Linda Ellerby is hosting Sticks, Stones, and Cyber Slams, a Nick News special on bullying. Public humiliation is a part of life for young people these days, and there's at least one primetime TV show that gets that, says Tavia Nyong'o, a professor of performance studies at New York University. He points to the show Glee.
Well, I think Glee is so important in this context because it really is a show that's hysterically funny and yet also about how to manage and maybe even transform experiences of public humiliation. From that very first episode when you have Kurt asking his bullies to let him take off his designer jacket.
Please, this is Marc Jacobs' new collection.
Wait. Before being thrown into the dumpster.
Shortly after hearing the news that Rutgers student Tyler Clementi committed suicide, Nyong'o was teaching a graduate student class at NYU. He says the students wanted to talk about whether a gay person coming out of the closet is relevant and about what it takes to withstand public humiliation.
We were talking about the misleading perception because there's been so much advances in visibility. There's no cost to coming out anymore. There's a kind of equal opportunity for giving offense and for public hazing and for humiliating. We should all be able to deal with this now because we're all equally comfortable in our own skins. Tragically, what Rutgers reveals is that we're not all equally comfortable in our own skin.
How people react to being publicly humiliated varies. Tyler Clementi has been described as quiet and shy. He may not have had the mental toughness it would take to get through it. Sociologist CJ Pasco says she was not surprised to learn that two students secretly put his sexual encounter online. But she cautions against blaming new technology for what they did.
I think the problem starts pre-technology, which is what are the motivations we have in humiliating another person and humiliating them sexually. That's the issue we need to deal with and then follow up with concerns about new media. I don't think the media itself caused us to have those types of motivations.
Even still, technology makes it easier to publicly humiliate someone on a whole new level. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.